All right, here we go. Didactic Mind, Episode 22. A New Hope for the Forgotten Man. Very warm welcome to all of my SoundCloud subscribers, to all of my loyal readers from the blog. It's great to have you here with me for the usual weekly podcast where I just ramble on for about an hour on whatever topic comes to mind. Hopefully we'll be able to avoid the sound issues that I had in my last domain query podcast, but we'll see how it goes. So today I basically wanted to talk about not so much the results of or the ongoing coronavirus crisis, bad as that is. I wanted to look forward to what we can expect from the economic depression, and it is going to be a depression that will result. And I wanted to take some time to look at past history and see how the world has reacted in past severe depressions and compare and contrast some of the likely outcomes. Now, this podcast is also about giving people hope because it seems very, very dark right now. It seems that we're living through a very hellish time. I am here to tell you this is nowhere near as bad as it's going to get. This is but a foretaste of what's to come when the world's overstressed, debt-based economy finally collapses, and it's going to happen. I don't believe hyperinflation will take place. I believe there will be serious debt deflation that takes place first, because it has to. The fact is too many people are in too much debt, and too many corporations have run up too much junk on their balance sheets. There's simply no way for any of this to be sustained, and so it won't be sustained. There will be serious sovereign debt crises coming our way. There will be massive flare-ups of internal dissension and outright civil war, which will be anything but civil, I'm afraid. And we're going to see massive repatriation programs of dirt worlders from the West back to where they came from, because they're going to have to go. The reality is that Western countries are simply not capable of taking in any more people from the third world who have third world attitudes, third world hygiene, third world habits, third world cultures. They're not compatible. As much as the civic nationalists would like you to believe they're compatible, they're just not. There's no way that you can take someone from China, plonk him into, let's say, New York City or Los Angeles or the Midwest, and expect him to be suddenly magically American. It's been proven beyond reasonable doubt now by what we're seeing in Australia, where quite large groups of Chinese people, at the behest of Chinese corporations and Chinese government agencies, state-run enterprises basically, are going into rural stores in Australia. Busloads of these people are going in there, buying up everything that they can find, stripping rural shelves bare, and then taking what they've gotten at a song and going either back to the big cities and selling it at a massive markup and thereby making a killing for themselves, or shipping all that stuff right back to China. Now, if this is not ingratitude of the highest order, I don't know what else you'd call it. I don't know how anyone can look at that kind of behavior and come to a conclusion other than that these people are not Australians, because they're not. They're not Australians in any way, shape, or form. And this is not isolated to Australia. Similar reports have been popping up in Europe with Chinese people doing the same thing. Similar reports have been popping up in America as well. Now, there is no call to abuse or discriminate against Asians in this regard. Just because some Asians have done this, some Chinese have done this, that does not mean that all Chinese are automatically bad people, because they're not. It also does not mean, however, that we should automatically believe the lie that bringing people from China or India or the Middle East or Africa or wherever else, or South America, into Western countries automatically makes them Westerners. That's idiotic. And one of the net positive results of Corona-chan's pestilential spread will be, I think, the destruction of the civic nationalist myth, which is very badly in need of destruction at this point. You can't really take the tribe out of the barbarian. That's the reality. It takes a long time to civilize barbarians, and that's what we're finding time and time and time again in the midst of a global crisis. That being said, there are hopeful lessons to take from this crisis, and there is reason for hope that things will ease, and sooner than we expect. For instance, one of the epidemiologists who came up with the original worst-case scenario that prompted the British government to launch a massive lockdown effort and a hugely intrusive campaign to keep everybody indoors, and gave the police very wide-ranging powers to lock up people just for walking the streets. Niall Ferguson, Professor, not Niall, sorry, Neil Ferguson. There's a historian named Niall Ferguson, who's a Scottish chap, and very well known among American right-wing circles because he's a conservative historian. And Neil Ferguson, Professor Neil Ferguson, based in London, I believe, who came up with an epidemiological model which originally predicted something on the order of 200,000 deaths, okay, in the UK alone. And he is not alone in these crazy, absolutely batshit insane modeling predictions. The American specialists from the CDC, who originally came up with some of the viral epidemiological models, predicted something like 2 million deaths in the US from corona, from COVID-19. That too is plainly absurd. As of this exact moment of recording, we are looking at 124,697 confirmed cases in the USA, and of those, 2,227 are fatal, meaning that the deaths involved can be reasonably blamed on Corona Chan. Now, what does that come to in percentage terms of active cases? Well, it comes to about 1.8%. Okay, a 1.8% death rate. Now, that's not comfortable, but it's not horrendous either. And remember, this is death rate against confirmed cases. That's not a very good denominator, because one of the realities of epidemiological modeling is that you can only check for those people who actually have the virus. If you stop testing, or if you don't get everyone involved in the test sample, then your death rates are always going to be wrong. And in this case, they're absolutely wrong. The very same Neil Ferguson, who came up with this, 200,000 deaths in the UK estimate, then revised his death rate downwards significantly. What was his actual death rate originally? I mean, let me make sure I've got these numbers right, in fact. Neil Ferguson originally predicted, let's see, originally predicted a huge number of deaths, and then he lowered the estimate. He said, actually, sorry, he didn't say 200,000, he said half a million. 500,000 deaths. So I was actually being too generous to him. I was being too nice to the guy. Neil Ferguson was one of the professors originally responsible for the panic in the UK and around the world, actually. He's revised his estimates downward significantly. A couple of days ago, he said, "Yeah, you know what? That original 500,000 death rate, that was way exaggerated. Our new models, based on the latest data, say we're looking at maybe 20,000 deaths." Okay, that's pretty bad. That's still, not great. But 20,000 deaths versus 500,000, that's a huge difference. Now he's revised it downward again to 5,700. Okay, for 5,700 dead people, you're basically destroying the entire British economy? Like, really? What? How does this make sense? How does this make sense? In the US, the original death rate was projected about 2 million based on the way this virus spread, and an assumption of about a 4 to 5% mortality rate. That mortality rate is nowhere close to the actual rate. The actual rate, under the absolute best conditions for this virus, under the gold standard, perfect petri dish environment for something like Corona-chan is actually close to 0.2%. How do we know this? Based on evidence from cruise liners, where you have literally the perfect environment for a virus to spread. You have a completely enclosed space. You have people in very close proximity, in very cramped quarters. You have lots and lots and lots of surfaces for a virus to grow on, especially metal surfaces, where it seems to thrive pretty well. You have climate-controlled conditions, where there's air conditioning running constantly. The Diamond Princess case is particularly telling. The Diamond Princess was that cruise liner which very famously got trapped in, I think, Japan it was. And basically, there were 3,700 people on board. 3,711, to be precise. Every single one of them was tested using the best available testing methods at the time. And those testing methods have gotten better since, but, you know, in the last 2 months alone. The testing methods showed that less than 20% of the people on board that ship got the virus, okay? So, how many people got the virus? About 740. 740-odd people were actually infected. Of those 740, roughly, people, how many died? Less than 10. Less than 10 people died from this, okay? What's that death rate come to? About 0.2%. 0.2%, okay? That's the high end of the mortality rate. Now, what does that imply for these horrifying numbers that we're seeing around the world? You know, 667,000 people infected globally as of this, well, 665,000 people infected globally as of the time of this recording, and it's going to go up to 670,000. We know that by the time you guys hear this podcast. What does that mean? Well, number one, it means that the true number of infected people is enormously higher than what we're seeing right now. It's about 10 times higher than what we're seeing. So instead of 665,000 people infected globally, the true number is almost certainly 6.65 million right now. So we're off by a factor of 10 in terms of the numbers that we're seeing. The data that we're looking at is absolute garbage, and yet we're basing national policy on data that we know is shit. It's absolute bullshit. And yet we're locking down entire economies. We're destroying entire industries. We're giving governments enormous powers that they've never had before and should never have had in the first place. And they're basically controlling our lives with it. This is a remarkably stupid and dangerous precedent. And there is no question that governments around the world are going to exploit it for their own gain. Among the Western countries, it's very clear that the governments which have responded in the most draconian fashion have also been the most inept in large measure. I mean, we're talking about Italy, Spain, France, the UK. Governments which have taken a relatively lighter hand, such as the USA, are actually doing better. Now, that is not the only factor in explaining the way that the US death rate is so much lower. We know, for instance, that US social distance is much larger than it is anywhere else in the world. Americans, I can say this from personal experience, because I have lived in India, I have lived in Indonesia, I have lived in Australia, I have lived in Singapore, I have lived in the UK, in London specifically, and I have lived in the USA, and I have lived in Russia, okay, for more than 6 months. So as far as I'm concerned, it counts. I've lived in 7 countries over the span of my life. I'm one of ye old farts now that I'm in my mid-30s, so I've got a pretty wide range of experience to speak from. I can tell you from my personal experience that the most standoffish people I've ever met are Americans. Americans really like their space. And that's a very good thing. That's one of the things I really like about Americans, because I like my space too. I'm very introverted. I like to be separated from everyone else, and I genuinely do have an attitude that, you know, most people are only tolerable well-boiled and with lots of salt. And I think most of my readers are the same way. And most of my listeners as well. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't be listening to me. But The wonderful thing about Americans is that their insistence on all of this space makes them naturally immune to some of the madness that goes on. And it also makes them deeply suspicious of government power. And we are very fortunate to see right now that the president is taking a relatively measured, not hysterical, careful, evidence-based look at what to do. He's not basing his entire policy only on what the epidemiologists say, and that's a very, very good thing. One point that I want to make very clear to my listeners and readers is that I've spent most of my professional life working with modeling of various kinds, mathematical modeling, okay? I understand something about how mathematical models work because my background is in mathematics. I have 2 degrees in the subject. I know how this stuff works at a fairly basic level, at a working level. If you give me an epidemiological model showing, you know, this is how, these are the infection rates, this is the exponential curve that we expect to see in the initial stages of the outbreak, this is the approximate, you know, the estimation of the bell curve that we're going to see in terms of the track over time, and so on and so forth, I will understand what's going on because I understand how the maths works. It's not difficult. It's actually no more difficult than, well, used to be what used to be high school level mathematics. Now is probably fourth year of college because of the decline in American education standards, but you know, it is what it is. The reality is this stuff is not hard to figure out. And I can tell you personally, from long personal experience, financial models tend to underestimate risk extremely badly. I mean, they underestimate it so much that they say that an event that, you know, a debt crisis or a sovereign debt default crisis or a financial panic should only happen once every 8 million years based off of the distribution, probability distribution that they're using in their models, which is a nice, well-shaped bell curve, a Gaussian distribution, if you will. And it's a beautiful-looking thing, but because it's so well-behaved, the tail events never occur with the frequency that we actually observe in the real world. So financial models always underestimate how bad things can get. Epidemiological models always overestimate how bad things can get. Everybody should remember back to 2009, where the big pandemic at the time was swine flu, H1N1, A/H1N1 to be specific. Now, swine flu wasn't actually pig flu. It was flu that had jumped from, it was like a stomach flu, basically, that had jumped from pigs to humans. That infected millions of people around the world, and the epidemiologists were running around screaming about how it was going to kill us all, and it was going to be a deadly pandemic, and it was going to destroy the world, and it was going to be even worse than 1918. Spanish flu, except it wasn't. None of those predictions came to pass. The actual results of swine flu 2009 pandemic were pretty restrained. About 500 people died in the USA, in the UK, excuse me. Let me correct that very clearly. About 500 people died in the UK. Now, that was after a prediction of, like, tens of thousands of deaths. It was nowhere near as bad as anyone said it was going to be. The mortality rates were nowhere near as bad as anyone thought. The total number of deaths confirmed, according to swine flu, were about, well, depending on who you talk to, between 15 and 20,000. Okay? That's it. 15 to 20,000, 3,400 some people died in the USA, 474 people died in the UK, mainland China, 800 people died, Russia, 604 people died, okay? Bulgaria, 40 people died, all right? And there were plenty of countries with fewer than 40 deaths, right? If you look down the list, Indonesia had 10 deaths. And, you know, just picking another country at random, Libya had one death from swine flu. this was simply not as bad as people thought. And yet, how many confirmed cases were there in all of these countries? Well, Belgium had 215,000 cases confirmed. Portugal had 167,000 cases. Iceland had per capita the highest number of cases, 8,650 confirmed cases. Germany, 192,000 cases. South Korea, 107, 108,000 cases. This was orders of magnitude. I mean, the total number infected in the entire world was 25,584,000 people. That is a full two orders of magnitude, 40 times, 40 times what we're being told right now is the total number of infected around the world. The death toll was around what we're seeing right now. It's a little bit less, actually. COVID-19 is more deadly. I mean, globally, there's about twice as many people dead from COVID-19 as from swine flu, about 30,000, 31,000 dead as of the time of this recording. So, while it is not accurate to say that COVID-19 is just a bad seasonal flu, it's a bit worse than that. It's also not accurate to say that this is horrendously bad. This is the end of the world. It's not, guys. Relax. This is not the end of the world. This is not going to break us. This is not going to destroy Western civilization. It's going to come close, but it's not going to destroy it. Okay? The only reason it's going to come close is because we let it come close. The realities of this virus are much more benign than we have been led to believe. Our governments, our media establishments, our pretty much anything to do with public health, any of those institutions have let us down horribly. The fact is, we're being led around by the nose by idiots and donkeys who have no clue how bad this can really get. So they're just, going to the worst-case scenario. And yet, when the data emerges showing us that it's not going to be that bad, when the data show us plainly that the results of this infection are nowhere near as bad as we expect, they refuse to let up. They refuse to give up their powers. They refuse to let life go back to normal. And that's what we desperately need right now, is a sense of normalcy again. Now, let me address one major issue which the optimists have not looked at or are kind of just ignoring. Yes, fact is that the danger of this virus is not in terms of the number of people it infects. The danger is in terms of its ability to overwhelm existing critical care systems. Here's something people need to know and understand very clearly about critical care systems, especially this whole issue of intensive care units and ventilators. All right? Understand something very clearly. Intensive care units are incredibly expensive to run and maintain, as they should be, because they require a level of dedication and concentration and cleanliness that is two or three orders of magnitude above that of a general, patient ward. Hospitals are designed to run on a small number of ICUs because the total demand for ICUs is small in a typical season. So, if you look at a large hospital, one of my readers actually told me about this. If you look at a large, well-run hospital in the United States, if you're living in New York, I don't know, let's call it Mount Sinai or Bethesda, or whatever, big, well-known hospital you want to talk about, Sloan Kettering, perhaps. Okay. That hospital probably doesn't have more than 50 ICU units. Most large hospitals in the United States will not have more than 14, 15, 20 at the most ICUs. Okay? 20 ICUs with 20 ventilators, maybe 30. All right? That's it. That's all they've got. Now, if you look at the transmission rates of COVID-19, we know that roughly 80% of the people who have COVID-19 will experience such mild symptoms that it won't even matter. They won't even register to them that they've got the problem. Of the remaining 20% or so, 20 percentage points, roughly 14% of that total infected population will require some sort of critical care. So, 80% will be totally fine, mild symptoms, no big deal. 6% will show fairly severe symptoms, but they can recover through home treatment. 14% will require critical care. And of that 14% chunk, out of, breaking it down even further, from the original infected population, another 5 or 6% will require such critical care that they need to be in an ICU. Okay? That's approximately what we observed from the data. So again, 80%, no to very mild symptoms. 6%, pretty bad symptoms, but they'll recover at home. 8%, really, really bad, really terrible symptoms which require critical care, round-the-clock observation and supplemental fluids, and constant need to drain fluid out of the lungs because they're getting so congested from the viral pneumonia. Another 6% in such bad shape that they need ventilators. And of the total population, again, of the entire population of infected, not the confirmed cases, not the people who are absolutely known to have this virus, of the total population of infected, whether confirmed tested or not, 0.2 to 0.5% of those will die. Okay, that's tragic, that's terrible. But the data from the UK make it very, very clear that most of the people who died from COVID-19 would have died anyway sometime later in the year. Why? Because they're old and frail and sick. Most of the people who have died from COVID-19, there are exceptions, and those are the exceptions are the ones making the headlines. But most of the cases from COVID-19 are old people with pre-existing medical conditions. There are four people who have died in Russia so far. Every single one of them had respiratory issues already or had another health issue of some kind. This is not a global population killer. And furthermore, we have to ask ourselves whether it makes sense to shut down the entire world economy for a virus that kills the oldest and least productive among us. Let's be clear about this. Let's be absolutely clear about this. The swine flu pandemic from 10 years ago killed children, okay? But there was no universal lockdown. There were some lockdowns around the world. There were some countries that closed their borders. There were some, travel bans and such. But there was nothing like this panic and frenzy that we're seeing right now. The reality is that we have completely inverted our social policy. And why is that? Well, let's be honest. In democracies, it's because the old farts are the ones who vote, by and large. This is very much a generational thing. The people who vote are the ones dying. So obviously politicians want to be seen to protect grandma, especially in election years. And it is an election year in the US, make no mistake. If it were, I remember seeing a news article basically saying something along the lines of, if children were dying in numbers that old people are dying right now, we'd insist on shutting down the entire economy and we would save the children. So, well, we've seen pandemics like that in the past, and that's not what's happened. We haven't shut down the entire economy to save the children. Right now, what we're doing is we're shutting down the entire economy to save the old farts who don't contribute much to the economy. And we're destroying the lives, bank accounts, and livelihoods of the young people who are necessary to keep the old farts alive. Okay? This is stupid. It is an inversion of social policy that makes any kind of sense. It is a huge mistake. A much more sensible thing to do is to simply let the economy open back up, let people go back to work, keep old people under quarantine and isolation, absolutely, institute more stringent cleaning and disinfecting measures for offices and buildings and public places around the world. That's a good idea. By all means, keep travel from China shut down as long as it takes, because the Chinese really need to be punished for what's happened. The Chinese government really needs to feel some pain. This was a Chinese virus. Make no mistake about that. This came from China and it destroyed the entire world's economy. It's their fault and they deserve to take the blame. This is on them, and this is not the first time it's happened. It won't be the last. The reality is the Chinese system is particularly well suited to letting epidemics and pandemics like this flourish. I was there in Singapore in 2003 when the SARS epidemic broke out. I saw what the Chinese did. They covered it up. They tried to lie about it. They refused to admit the truth. And Then, when it became clear that they couldn't hide the truth anymore, they finally admitted, oh yeah, we've got a problem. But then it was too late. 8,000 people around the world were infected, almost 800 of them died. There was absolutely nothing morally decent about the Chinese government back then. There is nothing morally decent about it now. The Chinese people are suffering under a regime that does not value their lives, doesn't value the lives of anybody else. It only values power. And based off of that, based off of that fact, and based off of the way that Chinese people behave among, you know, Western societies, there is no good reason to start inviting them in again. There is absolutely no good reason to let them back into the West. It's just that simple. When you see an entire group of people behave in a way that is antithetical to the interests of your nation, well, it just makes good sense to keep them out of your nation. It's just, I mean, it's obvious, right? But nonetheless, I remain deeply optimistic at my core that things will normalize after a week or two. I do believe that we've seen probably the worst of this. Not in some parts of the world. I think New York is going to get even worse. And by the way, you know, Democrats are praising Governor Andrew Cuomo for his great work in combating the virus. Guys, the reason coronavirus is in New York right now and killing people is because of Andrew Cuomo and that idiot Bill de Blasio. These were the people who insisted on keeping borders open, insisted on letting flights land, insisted on letting Chinese New Year celebrations go ahead, insisted on letting mass gatherings go ahead in the face of a highly transmissible, highly infectious, highly contagious, and to old people at least, highly lethal virus. I mean, it's not that lethal, but you know, when we're looking at the data coming out of Italy and Spain, it's pretty scary because old people are dying like flies from this virus. But even then, the mortality rates are between 10 and 15% for old people with pre-existing conditions. And again, I want to make this very clear, we can't believe any of the numbers from anywhere, all right? The USA is doing better than most at testing people, which is why the numbers keep tracking up. It's just because we're testing more. You know, the Americans are testing more and more people. They're finding more and more positives. All right, that's just obvious. The Chinese would have you believe that they've broken the back of COVID-19. They haven't. They've simply stopped testing people. That's all. They've stopped testing. So they say, oh, we only have only, quote unquote, about 80,000 people infected, and most of those are recovered. Bullshit. They do not have 81,439 confirmed cases. They have way, way, way more than that. And while 75,000 or so of them have recovered, the reality is that they have far more cases than they're letting on. They're doing the exact same thing that they did during SARS, and they're doing it to us the same way for the same reasons, because they can't afford to lose face. They're terrified of losing their authority over the people. And this is the Chinese mindset. You have to understand something about it. This is how they think. So don't be surprised when the footage comes out of China showing, oh, wait a second, we didn't actually conquer this virus. It's back, and it's worse. So nonetheless, despite all of that, despite all the craziness that's going on, I do want to give people a message of hope and optimism. We are going to beat this thing. It's going to be over soon. What remains to be seen is what will happen after the virus fades away. What are the economic consequences? Now, to look at the economic consequences, we have to look at our past history, and we have to look at a couple of different trajectories that the economies of the world can take. Before I continue, I want to mention a book which I think will be very useful reading for a lot of people listening to this. It's called The Forgotten Man by Amity Schles, and it is a phenomenal book. She's working on a follow-up. I don't know if she's published it yet, but if she has, I hope to read it soon. The Forgotten Man is a sort of personal history of the Great Depression, written from the perspective of the people who lived through it. It is a phenomenal book. It is brilliant. I mean, I read it in, I think, 2008. I must have been in Vancouver at the time. And I read through it in, you know, for me it was an absolute page-turner of a book. I couldn't stop reading it when I picked it up. It was phenomenal. It was just unbelievably good. When was it published? This was, 2007. This was published 13 years ago. So Amélie Schlés published this a long, long time ago. And I remember reading it sitting in a Vancouver hotel. I'd gone to get my what was it? H1B visa, actually. I'd gone to get my H1 visa, and I was watching the results of the US presidential election in early November in a Vancouver hotel, and it really rang very, it really resonated with me because obviously at the time, that was when the entire world's economy was collapsing under the strain of the financial crisis. Now, Amélie Schlés, in her book, writes about how the economy had actually started bouncing back from the collapse of 1929 to 1930. By mid-1930, by the middle of 1930, the US economy was showing very clear signs of recovery. What stopped that? Well, what stopped it was the interventionist policies of Herbert Hoover, not FDR. This is one of the great lies that we've been told. FDR was responsible for prolonging the Great Depression, and Herbert Hoover was very far away from a laissez-faire, do-nothing president. He did a lot. In fact, he made things much worse by putting in place lots of stupid public works projects, lots of unemployment benefit schemes, lots of kind of interventions into the free market to stop the economy from healing. The reality is that the economy needed to shed a lot of the excess productive capacity that had been built up through flawed monetary policy over the previous 5 or 6 years. The roots of the Great Depression can be traced back to very stupid, loose Federal Reserve policy. The results of the Great Depression come from endless interventions by meddling, stupid, unimpressive, intellectually bankrupt, and very, very foolish politicians, such as Herbert Hoover and such as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is routinely lauded as like the greatest president the US has ever had. He was one of the worst. He was one of the five worst presidents the US has ever had, which is saying something. I mean, considering that list includes Abraham Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, and who else? You know, a couple of others. Jimmy Carter, obviously. Barack Obama's in that list, probably, although he and George W. Bush would be fighting over a particular position in that list of worst ever presidents. But, you know, the reality is that Roosevelt's interventions made much worse an existing crisis. Now, if you look at the course followed by the United States during the Great Depression of wage and price controls, of constant meddling in the free market, of the what was it called? The there's a specific act, the NRA, the Roosevelt NRA. What was it called? I forget. That National Recovery Administration. That's it. Excuse me. My history's a little fuzzy. The National Recovery Administration was struck down by a Supreme Court law ruling, excuse me, and the entire goal of the NRA was to eliminate cutthroat competition, which was unbelievably stupid, because it decided to try to align everything in terms of fair practices and set prices, and it was created by the National Industrial Recovery Act. Now, anybody who understands anything about economics understands that the government setting prices for what can and cannot be transacted is an unbelievably dumb thing to do. This was a disaster on multiple fronts, and it was rightly struck down by the Supreme Court. How did FDR react? By threatening to pack the court. He said, "If you do this to me again, I'm going to put in lots of liberal justices who will do exactly what I want, and I have the power to do it because I have complete majorities in both houses. I'm going to destroy the Supreme Court. And if you know, if you don't rule the way I want you to rule, you're out." So, of course, the Supreme Court kowtowed and bowed down before presidential authority, which was a huge mistake. And the result was a 10-year-long depression, which honestly could have been eliminated. Because again, in 1930, the economy was recovering. By 1935, 1936, the economy was recovering again, despite the stupidity of the Roosevelt administration. But the Roosevelt administration kept meddling, kept intervening, kept forcing things, forcing square pegs into round holes. This is the danger of following an interventionist course of action, once everything kind of normalizes after Corona-chan dissipates. A lot of governments are going to do this, and a lot of countries are going to suffer terribly as a result. This is where President Trump, or as I like to call him, his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, has a chance to do something much more sensible. Let's look back even farther in time, 100 years, exactly 100 years, to the Depression of 1920 to 21. What happened there? The Depression of 1920 to 21 is something that most people don't know about from their history books because it's never taught. But it was an extremely sharp contraction in the U.S. economy caused by the removal, essentially, of all of the World War I price and output controls and wage controls that were implemented by the Wilson administration. Now, Woodrow Wilson, in sort of September or thereabouts of 1919, suffered a massive stroke, and he was basically incapacitated. This was a very, very good thing, by the way. This was a very good thing because he had been running the country into the ground. And his insistence on going on all these speaking tours to get the Treaty of Versailles ratified by the US Senate and by world governments left him exhausted and weak. He suffered a stroke, and for quite a long time, basically for the remainder of his term, more or less, it was effectively his wife running the country. The true nature, the true depth of his problem was hidden from most of the public. And again, I mean, this was entirely anti-constitutional. The 25th Amendment exists in the Constitution for a very good reason, and it was passed, I believe, after the Wilson administration came out, you know, was removed from power. It was ratified, whenever, where was it? Yeah, in the 1960s, right? So this was way after the Wilson administration, but something like the 25th Amendment should have been there from the beginning, and it wasn't. Yeah, what can you do? Woodrow Wilson should have been removed from power. His vice president should have taken over, but none of that happened. Anyway, if wishes were horses, all beggars would ride, you know. The point is, the 1920 Depression happened because all of these price controls, which had artificially maintained output and wages above the level that they should have been, were removed. Now, there is also some blame assigned to the New York Federal Reserve, which had been around for about 7 years at that point, because the Federal Reserve came into existence in 1913. If you want a good book to read about that, read The Creature from Jekyll Island, which I referenced in a past domain query episode. The New York Fed had started raising interest rates from about 4.7 to 5%, thereabouts, in the months leading up to the Great Recession. But that in and of itself is not sufficient, because the New York Fed did not control the entire country. And the Federal Reserve as a whole did not begin open market operations until about 1924. So the reality of that period in time is that the Depression was caused entirely by the need, the desperate need, to refocus resources away from wartime production to peacetime production, and the refusal of the Wilson administration to let that happen. Once it finally happened, of course, the overhang was so great that the Depression was inevitable. But how did the U.S. get out of it? Because if you look at the statistics, it really was a terrible depression. I mean, unemployment went up anywhere between, depending on who you look at, either if you look at Christina Romer's statistics or an older set of statistics by, I forget exactly what his name is, but unemployment went up by anywhere from 3 to 10 times. One set of stats that I've seen indicates that unemployment went from like 1.5% to 11%. That's the older set. The Roma statistics say it was more like 3% to 9%, thereabouts, or 8%. So whatever it was, whatever the truth is, the drop in output was enormous. The spike in unemployment was enormous. The destruction of productive capacity was enormous. And yet, within 6 months to a year, well, within 6 months, the recovery had already started. Within a year, the roaring 20s had begun. What gives? How did that happen? The answer is that wages fell much more slowly than prices, as is the norm. Wages generally fall much more slowly than prices do. That is how economies work. People don't accept pay cuts easily, but prices for goods always fall very quickly. That is the same thing that we're going to see happening in the near future. Prices for goods are going to collapse all across the economy. Wages are going to fall significantly as well, but nowhere near as fast. So, how did the USA get out of that depression? It's very simple. The USA got out of it by simply having a stable business environment. That's it. That's all people need right now. They need stability, and they need predictability. And once that happens, the rest will more or less take care of itself. That is where governments around the world need to resist the temptation to intervene wherever possible. And they're not going to be able to resist it. I mean, already that idiotic $2.2 trillion stimulus bill that just passed through the House and Senate is an abomination in a lot of ways. I mean, it's got plenty of really good ideas in terms of reducing the total amount of taxes paid. That's great. Giving people tax relief, that's wonderful. Giving small businesses loans at very low rates of interest to get restarted again, that's a good idea, that's all fine. But it blows out the debt massively to a point where the U.S. can't afford it anyway. I mean, we all know the U.S. economy is putting on more debt than it can possibly service. It's going to collapse under the burden of its own debt eventually anyway. Okay, so we don't even need to worry about it. It's going to happen. Like, there's no preventing it at this point. The entitlements crisis is so bad, and the amount of debt circulating through the U.S. economy is so great. The collapse from debt overhang is going to happen. So anybody who's complaining about, oh my God, this adds to like an existing 110% of GDP debt, you know, it's going to blow out to 120%. Like, guys, relax. We know. There are countries in the world right now that have 200% of their GDP in debt issued, outstanding right now. And they're still solvent. And people still lend them money. Japan is a good example of that. And there are plenty of countries around the world which have spent far more than they can afford to spend. And they're still solvent. And they're going to remain solvent for a long time until the final debt crisis really starts. And when that happens, they're all going to go bankrupt very, very fast. So it's going to happen. Prepare for it. Be ready for it. But don't be surprised when it happens. There's no saving that system now. It's too far gone. So if you look at the US economy, and if you look at what the God Emperor has done, he's put in a lot of very sensible ideas to get things restarted. But he has to resist the temptation to engage in control over entire sectors of the economy. If he does that, that's it. We're looking at a 10-year-long depression again. I remember what it was like under the Obama administration, maladministration. It was brutal. I mean, the feeling was of an 8-year-long malaise. It was just misery for 8 years. I remember starting work when Obama entered office in 2008. I actually started work in 2007, after I graduated from my master's program. And I remember feeling that this was a depression of the worst kind, because I came out of 4 years of professional experience in 2011, and my salary hadn't changed. It was like I hadn't seen a pay raise or a promotion in 4 years. And that continued to be the case for another 3 years after that. I didn't get a pay raise, I didn't get a promotion until 2015. So 8 years after I started my career, I finally got promoted. I finally got a bump in pay. That's how bad it was. It was an 8 to 10 year long depression. And then the God Emperor came along and started liberalizing huge sectors of the economy and basically gave people freedom to do what they needed to do once more. And surprise, surprise, with freedom, people did exactly what people do, which is engage in productive, useful enterprises, start up businesses, take risks, put capital on the table, build things with it, instead of hoarding it, instead of keeping it under the bed. If the God Emperor can maintain that stable business environment and resist the temptation that will come to meddle too deeply within it, if the God Emperor can avoid the temptations that the idiots over on the other side of the pond have already given into, and try to make the US a green economy, God help us, as Boris the giant fluffy cuddly sheepadoodle in the UK has already promised to do, then you're going to see a massive bounce back. And I do believe this. I do believe that the forgotten man in the United States is going to see a huge bounce back. The economy is going to come roaring back, provided that the God Emperor doesn't take too many stupid chances with attempting to control sectors of the economy. As long as he avoids doing that, things will get better very, very quickly. Why? Because the current lockdown is not a financial collapse. It's not due to a massive overhang in debt that finally got cold. It's due entirely to government-mandated shutdowns and stoppages of business. Once you remove those, and once people have some certainty about what government policy is going to be for the next 6 months to 2 years, then all of a sudden you're going to see the productive capacity of the greatest economy on earth unleashed. And it's going to be marvelous to watch. It's going to be incredible. I'm saying this as somebody who has suffered a lot from watching my stock portfolio get crushed, from watching my assets dwindle. It's pretty bad out there right now. Make no mistake, it's a bad time right now. But it's going to end. And when it ends, assuming that policymakers don't make too many dumb mistakes, things will get better, especially in the United States, because you have a man in charge who actually knows what the hell he's doing. He understands what it means to run a business. He's not a politician, he's a businessman. So he's going to start doing things in a way that makes sense for business. And he is a man who understands what it means to employ large numbers of people and what is necessary to employ those people. This cannot be said of governments around the world. If you look at governments in Europe, excuse me, had to wet my whistle there. If you look at governments in Europe, they have no understanding of what it takes to run businesses. So they think that everything can be solved through government policy and central planning, and it can't. In America, you have a president who understands the need to let business thrive. And once these lockdowns are lifted, once the shutdowns are lifted, once normal air traffic can resume, at least somewhat, hopefully it remains shut down, going to and from China for a good long while. The Chinese absolutely, as I said before, deserve to be punished for what's been done. I really hope that the God Emperor hikes tariffs even higher and really, you know, makes them feel the pain, because that would be very much advisable at this point. You know, puts tariffs on every single thing that China ever sends over to the US. That will be a very good thing. And one of the ancillary benefits of this whole process will be that people are going to learn the lesson of moving critical infrastructure and production back to the mainland. If nothing else, Corona-chan has done tremendous good. It doesn't look like it, but she's actually done tremendous good by destroying the myth of the outsourced economy. Life doesn't work like that. Outsourcing doesn't work particularly well. And I say this as somebody who worked for banks where the back office functions were heavily outsourced. That was a huge mistake, because everything that the back office did in India was of pretty universally terrible quality. The only thing that they were good for really was basically scanning documents and following a checklist of procedures. Anyone who thinks that Indians, by and large, are an innovative and driven people, you all probably haven't really dealt with Indians much. I have, and they're not like that. They're really not. They're just not. There are plenty of very, very cutthroat and talented businessmen among them, that's true, but they're concentrated in very specific ethnic subgroups. And overall, Indians are really basically good at following a checklist of instructions. They're not good at following, they're not good at innovating, they're not good at coming up with new ideas. They're just not. They aren't really built for that. I don't know why, but they're just not. All of that being said, the great benefit of this will be that critical infrastructure and manufacturing is going to move back to the States. Critical infrastructure for manufacturing pharmaceutical supplies and medical equipment and devices will go back to the USA because people are going to realize that the lower costs are not worth the risk. It's not worth the risk of letting China control 90% of the world's pharmaceutical supplies. It's not worth the risk of letting India shut off all exports of paracetamol and ibuprofen clones because they want to hoard those supplies for themselves. It's not worth the risk of letting other countries dictate to the United States what can and cannot be imported. It's just not worth it. Because another pandemic will come, and it's going to be much worse than this one. Another pandemic will arrive someday, most likely from China, again. Because, again, the Chinese just have this habit of doing this crap. Their entire system is perfectly geared toward letting a deadly sickness loose upon the population, covering it up, insisting that nothing's wrong, letting tens of thousands of people potentially die. I'm not saying that's what happened this time, but it could happen in the future. Certainly hundreds of people died before the Chinese woke up and realized, oh, wait a second, we've actually got a huge problem here. Putting an entire economy or nation at risk because of the actions of one bad actor is not worth the trouble. So you're going to see jobs come back in places that you didn't expect. The service sector in the United States has been hammered, absolutely brutalized, and there's no doubt about that. It's going to take time for that to recover, but it will recover. We're going to look back upon this time a year from now, and I honestly believe a lot of us are going to go like, what the hell was the fuss all about? Why was this such a panic? It didn't deserve it. The reason it was such a panic is because old people who vote were the ones being targeted by the virus. It's just that simple. In future, when those people are out of the way and they're gone, maybe the rest of us will realize that baby boomer narcissism and self-absorption are not character traits that we want to follow. Maybe we will look back and realize that older generations, the interests of older generations should not supersede those of younger ones. And maybe we will realize that destroying entire economies simply to preserve a bunch of old farts is not a good idea. And maybe we will realize that the forgotten man has a voice and that there is reason for hope and optimism even in what seems to be the darkest of times. That's all that I have to say because we are coming up on the 1 hour mark and I want to wrap things up. And my voice is going because I'm not used to speaking for long periods of time and I don't particularly enjoy it, to be honest. And, you know, my coffee's running out. So, regardless, I do actually enjoy making these podcasts. It's just the effects on my voice are a bit deleterious. But I hope you have found this educational. I hope you have found it enlightening. I hope that you will take the time and trouble to explore some of the ideas that I've mentioned. Definitely read the book that I talked about, The Forgotten Man by Amity Schles. I will include a link in the description box. And most importantly, stay optimistic. Stay hopeful. Things are going to get better, and they're going to get better a lot faster than we can imagine. Be on your guard, be safe, be healthy, but be hopeful as well. Pray, wash your hands, give thanks to the Lord for everything that He has given you. And remember, this too shall pass. We're going to get through it. We're going to be okay. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 22, a New Hope for the Forgotten Man. I am Didact, and I will see you on the next one.